It's time for the Packet Pushers Podcast.
Too much networking.
Rooters, witches, firewall,
internet.
A podcast on the data networking industry. Rooting, switching, design, strategies, daily work life, or whatever we find interesting. Whatever it is, we'll talk about it. Be ready. Welcome to Packet Pushers, a podcast where we discuss events, technology and work life in the data networking world. During the week, we curate various ideas, then get together to discuss them. We cover routing, switching, security, internet and happenings in and around the networking industry. Our core team are here again this week, and I'd like to welcome Ethan Banks. How are you doing this week, Ethan?
I've had a good week. I've been upgrading firewalls and doing password recovery on a lot of Cisco boxes, got a lot of stuff done, and I'm tired right now. I did a little mountain biking yesterday and fell off my bike, and you'd think this would have happened out on the trail. No, it was just on the street getting ready to meet a friend of mine to go on the trail. I'm hopeless, I'm old, I'm fat, and that's how my week has been.
That's kind of embarrassing. It's good of you to admit it. And that other voice in the background there is Dan Hughes. How have you been this week, Dan?
I've had a great week, Greg. I've spent the whole week sitting in front of a large screen with OmniGraph full, trying to design a network, trying not to be disturbed at every point where I was to forget start forgetting detail.
Yeah, and how are you finding OmniGraphle? I know you just picked up OmniGraphle. OmniGraphle, for those of our listeners who don't know, OmniGraphle is a drawing package on the Mac. It's a native. It's mostly Visio compatible, but those of us who use Macs tend to use OmniGraphle. So,
it's a great package. I've actually really fallen in love with it. I was kind of originally looking for something that's going to be like Visio, but probably not as good for a Mac. I've actually gone the other way around, and I actually think it's better. I would rather use this than use Visio. So I'm really happy. Outputting is the general feedback that most people give it as not so great. So in other words, compatibility back to Visio afterwards. And I don't care about that because I don't want people to edit things after I've created them.
Yeah, I have to use. I do have to export my data back to Visio for most things. So I actually have Visio installed in an emulator program on my Mac. But it is a real challenge. In that sense, I wish I could use it much, much more. Well, let's move on to the topics for this week. The first one that we wanted to talk about this week was that the CCIE routing and switching exam removed the OEQs. There was an announcement this week where Cisco came out and announced that they were removing all of that. And if we sort of look back a little bit at what happened there, the OEQs were brought into the exam, from what we can see, at least from the outside, to address some of the cheating issues that was happening out in Asia. There were suggestions that people out there were getting around certain lab questions in various ways, and this was one way that they really seemed to address that problem. But this week they've announced that they've taken them off. So it's a long time since I was on my exam. Has anybody...
I suppose the way I'd look at it, I mean, the cheating thing is... well, it certainly was when I was doing mine. It's probably around the same time as you, Ethan. It was horribly prevalent. It actually scared me how many people seem to be using these PassForSure and other brain dump type sites. And... I suppose it's very difficult. If you've ever tried to put together lab scenarios yourself, it is actually really horribly time-consuming to try and get it to get a lab scenario that will interoperate and have the questions all working off each other tightly. So I know it's very hard for Cisco to constantly be changing the actual lab exam themselves, which is why they came to this sort of concept of lots of short questions that they can quickly change and easily change and easily mark. The problem I had with the OEQs was a language thing. It's easy for the three of us to forget that most of the people out there, or certainly within Europe, most of the people who would be doing the lab are not English first language. And I remember being on boot camp, and a lot of the guys there were saying, you know, what is this? Is this a technical challenge, or is this a language challenge? And they were finding it to be a language challenge instead. So I never went with the OEQ thing at all as a way around this. The troubleshooting questions that have been put in instead seems to be a much more sensible approach to me. That would sort of something that would not be as challenging for people who had lots of experience in troubleshooting networks, which is kind of what you want, but would be a challenge to guys who have read this from a book.
Well, my take on it from what I was studying is that it was easy to get a pass for sure, one of those other vendors for a written exam, but not the lab exam. So I didn't, I guess I missed that part about the OEQs being targeted at stopping people from cheating on the lab. It sounds like from what you're saying, people were getting full copies in the lab
and then
going to sit it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I've heard stories of, like, you know, 30 or 40 candidates in a classroom, and one would go off, sit the exam and come back and then talk about it. You know, I could imagine this scenario. You know, if you get 30 or 40 candidates in a room in a training center somewhere, one could go to the exam and come back and tell the others, you know, what was going on. And if that kept going round and round, then eventually they would have a pretty good idea on any given week what was actually on the exam. And OEQs was one way to stop that, because that was the one you had to be very broadly knowledgeable to answer those. And, of course, troubleshooting.
Certainly I saw a number of people that had reports of failing their lab just because of the OEQs. When they got their score report back, that was the area that they failed. They were able to actually configure the lab and do successfully well on all the topic areas, but the OEQs failed them. That, to me, seemed wrong somehow. I don't know. I never saw an open-ended question to know exactly what the content was.
It's a difficult one, because in my day, troubleshooting was an entire day. Sorry, it was a half a day. So I was one of the people who went through the two-day exam many years ago, and the first day was the first day and a half was the configuring up of something, and then the second half of the second day was troubleshooting a network. And it could either be the network that you've built, or you would load a whole new scenario and tear it down. And there's no way to train for that. Even if you knew what was coming, you'd still have to. It's a very dynamic, very creative process, and I've always regretted that the CCIE program moved away from troubleshooting, because it's a mindset, it's a skill in itself to be able to logically attack problems.
And if you think about it, it's kind of what differentiates the lab exam from any of the other sort of Prometric style exams. All of the stuff you do in your local Prometric center is kind of around theory. It's, do you know the answer to this question that we're going to ask you? Whereas the great thing with the lab is, or should be anyway, is it's a way of sorting those who can do from those who can talk about. And you're right, Greg, that, you know, they do seem to have kind of moved away from that. I mean, I know you used to get points for racking your routers right, didn't you, when you did yours?
That was even before my time. The stories I heard back in my day was they actually used to... the troubleshooting part where they actually used to put sticky tape across the console cables.
Wow.
And use faulty...
That's a good one.
That's right. So I had some friends who, say, back in the days when numbers were sort of 2,500, 3,000, the proctors used to keep faulty serial cables handy, and then you'd leave the room and they would then break the network by plugging in faulty cables and all sorts of things, actually give you faulty equipment. And the troubleshooting actually included...
Well, I was just going to make the point that my lab didn't have an official troubleshooting section, but there were definitely broken pre-configurations that were in there. And you kind of knew that going in, that was a possibility, that the proctors were going to pre-configure some things incorrectly and you'd have to deal with it. And I ran into that in my lab, where some things just weren't working right until I resolved certain issues that the proctors had misconfigured on purpose. But it wasn't a long, drawn-out troubleshooting official section. It was just kind of integrated into the overall lab, so it's a little different. Anyway.
All right. On the whole, I think that the OEQs were, my view generally is that the OEQs were there to attack some changes in the marketplace, and that now that troubleshooting has been returned to the routing and switching exam, I think that the OEQs are largely redundant. And also, of course, the OEQs were being given waivers by Cisco to certain training companies and not to others, and there was a perception of a bit of a marketing failure there by Cisco yet again to failing to understand perception. Cisco marketing, you just love them, son. Okay, well, the second topic I wanted to talk about this week that we wanted to talk about was that the F5 has announced Big IP 10.2. And in the 10.2 code, there's a particular feature called EtherIP, which is a technology where we support IP tunneling over the backbone. I'm not completely au fait with this. So, Ethan, you raised this topic. Maybe you could have a go at this one.
I did a little research on this. I thought it was an interesting idea. What F5 has done is taken the... They say that they've done a standard Ether IP tunnel. So if that's the case, that's based on RFC 3378. Ether IP tunneling takes a full layer 2 Ethernet frame, throws a 2-byte Ether IP header on it, and then throws an IP wrapper around it so that it can get tunneled to wherever it needs to go. And so you can therefore bridge an Ethernet LAN segment across an IP network. Okay, straightforward as far as it goes. What they're really targeting this for is vMotion. If you are a VMware shop and you are using vMotion so that you can take a VMware host and move him from one VMware host to a physically different server, what VMware is giving you with that vMotion is the ability to move that host without interrupting service to the user. Well, now F5 is saying, all right, you can do that with a vMotion, and now we're going to let you do this to a VMware host that sits behind an F5 load balancer and actually move your VMware host to a totally different data center. That's what they're targeting. That's the goal of it. And they've done some other VMware integration as well in the past. So this is just an evolution of F5's relationship with VMware and getting deep inside a VMware environment to do cool F5 things. So, okay, this is what they're doing with this tunnel. You move your box, your client that was talking to that VMware host is still coming into the same load balancer, only now they're going across this Ether IP tunnel that could be in a completely different data center, and they'll keep your sessions nailed up between your host and this VMware box. They'll make sure that connection state is maintained and all of that. So it sounds pretty cool. There's quite a bit to configuring it and building up the correct VLANs and so on. I spent some time looking at it. They didn't cover it in quite as much detail as I might have liked, but you build a tunnel and you build some VLANs to support it, and you have some special monitor checks so that the F5s can follow where the host is moved to, is how I interpreted it.
There's a bit more to it than that. Doesn't it also integrate with the Global Traffic Manager, which is their DNS load balancing tool? And there's also you can also license the WAN optimization module so that it actually accelerates the traffic as it goes between sites.
Well, that was in the white paper that you sent me just before the show that I haven't had time to read yet. Now, in the 10.2 release notes where they cover what this feature is, they don't mention any of the GTM bits at all. But in the white paper in the network design guide, that's there where they talk about integration with GTMs.
Yeah. See, I would think the GTM is so that you can present an IP address forward to the internet. So at the moment where we use root health injection to reverse root inject upstream to say this IP address is at this data center or at this data center, GTM abstracts that even further and says, well, that host is moving from there to there, and then updates the DNS to migrate the host from site to site. And that might be an additional step rather than a requirement for the features. It's a little unclear at the moment.
Well, that piece with the GTM would be, if we're looking at the feature of vMotion specifically, where a client can continue to work uninterrupted while that vMotion exercise is done and the host moves from one place to another, that kind of implies that the IP address does not change. And for certain applications, it couldn't change, or the application service would definitely get broken. So I think there's another piece here, a different sort of a failover scenario that they're offering in the design guide, as opposed to the, just the straight up, hey, you can move a host to a whole different data center, your client's never going to know the difference.
I suppose maybe it's an add-on to say, okay, so our existing client doesn't know the difference, but any new client going off and doing DNS resolution to find the host is going to get moved automatically to the new data center, so that you're not actually going to have to use the bridge tunnel, maybe.
I can see that.
I'm speculating there, obviously. The only aspect to this, I suppose, if you can add in the optimization and the GTM sort of synchronization, then I can see why you would use F5 to do this. Without those two things, you'd kind of think, well, if we're going to do a pile of network bridging here, would we not do that from our existing network equipment, be it Cisco or Juniper or whomever we're using? would that not be the place to bridge, rather than introducing a new sort of tier into the into what's actually controlling the layer two networking?
Well, it would, and there's the reason for that is, of course, is that although this fixes the requirements of the front end of the actual VMware, but it doesn't fix the storage replication. So even though you might migrate a VMware host from site A to site B, your data store isn't solved by this issue. So you still have to have another mechanism to replicate data from site A to site B.
Well, there is a vMotion storage component that I think is implied here.
I mean,
if you're moving your host to a physically different server, you moved your storage as well. So there'd be, and I don't think that's an F5 dependent piece.
It's an F5 independent piece.
Right. Sure. Yeah. I mean, the implication is you vMotion your box elsewhere, then you're into a different data center, and maybe you're using this Ether IP tunnel that F5's offering you to get the traffic over.
Yep.
But when you brought that host up in the other data center, then the storage is there as well because you're leveraging some other VMware technology to make that happen.
Yeah, in the automation process, you still need to execute the storage vMotion, then execute the vMotion.
Mm.
So it doesn't solve all the problems. I think I've actually spent the better part of the last 3 months designing a Layer 2 data center interconnect, and I've been down a whole range of strategies around, you know, VPLS and EOMPLS over GRE and, you know, all sorts of esoteric solutions to come down to it. And they are strategically more viable for larger data centers. So where you have a large number of undefined service flows and you need layer 2 extensions between data centers, I would tend to go down the path of layer 2 data center interconnect. But if you're a medium-sized .com who has two data centers and you're using VMware, this provides a very viable solution for that sort of, you know, that capability.
A .com or an enterprise, I mean, you're just a small enterprise, you've got one specific thing you're trying to solve, and F5 kind of bundles it all up nice and tidy in a few different PDFs. Read through these, do this configuration, and hey, you can slide your VMware instance around between data centers. There you go. It's all magic.
But even worse, you've got iControl and iRules, which is the ultimate gateway drug to F5 dependency.
Absolutely.
As soon as you start writing scripts in iRules and using iControl, you know, using PowerShell with iControl, you just like, it's like mainlining heroin. That you just don't want to go away. The next thing that we wanted to look at this week in black market for IPv4 addresses, there was an article this week about on Slashdot. The routing internet registers have already issued, I think it's 12 /8s this year, and yet last year and the entire year they've only issued 8. And the dawning apocalypse where IPv4 address exhaustion is going to occur seems to be happening much faster than we might have thought. And there's always been a case where once it was obvious that IPv4 was going to run out, that people would suddenly run out and start to grab more addresses so that they could say, well, I'll go out and get another /20 so I've got some to tide me over and I don't have to go to IPv6. And then, of course, that leads the pundits, shall we say, to start saying that there's a black market for IPv4 addresses where people will then start to trade them. There's two sides to this, of course. One is that IPv4 is going to run out and there will be lack of access to IPv4 addresses. And B, when the hell are we going to implement IPv6?
It's a very good question. It's one I've been looking at myself because it is actually an issue for the company I work for at the moment. It seems to be the way it's going to go, certainly within sort of Western Europe and the United States. Most of the ISPs that you are dealing with have lots of IP addresses. There isn't that much of a problem. As they've been getting tighter allocating to individual enterprises, they've been sort of reclaiming a lot of address space back. So these guys aren't too worried. If you're looking for provider independent space, it is much more difficult. But for the vast majority of people out there who are using provider allocated addressing, it's kind of not that big of a deal in these regions. When you go to the developing internet developing, let me put it, part of the world, so places where you have fast growth of internet access, so the obvious candidates being places like India and China, where the ISPs don't have big historical blocks of IP addresses to call on and are actually going out to the registers and saying, guys, we need more addresses. This is where the growth in IPv6 is really going to come along. And the problem you have as somebody who's providing service globally is if these guys are building their infrastructure on the principle of IPv6, if you want to be able to sell to these guys, you're going to have the IPv6 in place. And you can do all of the hogging IPv4 that you want to, but it isn't actually going to help you in terms of your ability to provide service out there, which if you're a .com or if you're in any way dependent on, you know, internet for your for the services you provide to the world, then it's going to be very limiting.
For sure.
It's interesting to me, Dan, what you were just saying about the U.S., Western Europe, the ISPs tend to have a lot of address space. When I talk to ISPs, they're not even asking me if we're interested in IPv6. They don't. It's not even on their list. But also, like you say, if I go to Aaron and say I need a /20, a /22, they're going to fight me hard. They don't want to give it up anymore. They don't want to give any addresses out.
Exactly.
So I actually went
looking for IPv6 space for IPv6 connectivity from a number of our ISPs recently. And this is, bear in mind, in data center hosting. So it's not even like we're talking about, you know, at the end of the lease line or something. In the data center stuff, typically the providers have a lot more control over their equipment. They're directly connected to their backbones. You'd think it'd be the first place where this would be available. Every single one of them said no. They were not able to provide IPv6 to me. And these were big companies. These were not, you know, two-bit operators. So the only way I can actually look at doing this is to go to the sort of likes of Hurricane Electric and get a tunnel in. Which is fine, but it's not really ideal in a hosting environment. You would expect.
Well, Greg, I think that really speaks to your original question, which was, well, when are we going to go to IPv6? I think the reason that it hasn't happened is it's not as simple as changing the IP addressing scheme to something bigger and all the rest of the stuff that we know and love about TCP/IP works the same. It's a whole different animal. It's not just the addressing. It's also the way... everything from ARP to how routing neighbors are discovered and so on is different. All the mechanisms are different. It feels different. It's not. I think people that look at it are intimidated by it, and they're like, you know, as long as I can put this problem off, I'm going to put it off because I don't want to have to figure this whole thing out.
Well, I'll tell you what I did recently, which was I recently built a proxy server infrastructure for a large enterprise. And in the past, people have always put their proxy servers on the inside of the network. And what I did in this design was I now have an inside interface into the IPv4 inside the enterprise. And on the outside of the proxy server, I've plugged it directly into a public interface with a public IP address. So that when the IPv6 switchover comes, the only places that I have to change for IPv6 is my external firewalls and the external IP address of my proxy server. And you know what I've just done? I've just taken my entire enterprise and give them IPv6 internet access, because the TCP connection comes from the client, the desktop, to the proxy server, and then the proxy server initiates the three-way handshake again out to the internet. So it's actually an IPv4 to an IPv6 emulator. And I spoke to a few people about that, and not too many people have actually twigged to that sort of way of handling IPv6. So this way, I can now keep inside of my enterprise and have IPv6 internet access, which is going to delay the deployment of IPv4, but has the benefit of forcing carriers to support IPv6 today. Why can't carriers get on with IPv6? Are we really not paying them enough money to upgrade their networks? I mean, my telecoms bills are staggeringly large. Surely there's enough revenue there for the service providers to go and overhaul their networks and get this done.
But has it been enough of a priority for them? I know Sprint, for example, here in the U.S. has been shutting down frame relay networks in preparation for MPLS and forcing their frame customers to go over to MPLS. So that's where their energy has been put. It hasn't been on changing over to an IPv6 infrastructure or offering that as a service. And maybe there's other things tying up the telcos. And maybe, is it an expertise question? I mean,
If you're shutting down frame relays today, that means that the MPLS network started, 7 years ago? So they would have started the push into MPLS, and then it would have taken 3 or 4 years to develop, and then it would have taken 3-4 years to roll out, and now they're in the closeout phase of a 10-year program. So in that sense, I guess when the MPLS network started, maybe they didn't have IPv6 then. And it's not on the roadmap. But, you know, if you read the notes from the IPv6 forums and the various websites, the carriers are all going, not yet, not now, it's not, nobody asking, nobody wants it. But nobody wants it because nobody's asking, and nobody's asking because everybody knows that it's not there. It's kind of like a spiral of death.
It's a self-fulfilling prophecy, yeah.
Look at it this way, guys. It's good news for us because we're going to get to a point in a year, maybe 2 years, whenever it'll be, where this will turn into a huge panic. So go out there, learn your IPv6, know the solutions, and it'll be like Y2K all over again.
In a down economy? Bring it on.
Absolutely.
I agree. And the other thing that I want to encourage people to do, and one of the things that I'm doing, is when I do go for IPv4 allocations, I want to bring on the apocalypse. I think the only way to drive IPv6 is to exhaust the IPv4 addresses.
Just to bring it about, huh?
Bring it about, yeah. So, kids, when you go out there and you sit there and say a /24 will do, go for a /22. You know, and if you're going for a /22, go /20. Let's get rid of all those IPv4 addresses so we can get on with IPv6.
I say
you
we
heard
start
it here, kids.
There's ISP and go for a /8. Let's do it.
Oh, we've got the .NET already at packetpushers.net, so we're halfway there.
I haven't put IPv6 on there yet. I'm not likely to. I don't believe my hosting provider's got IPv6. It's a bit disappointing, but there you go. Okay.
Not as I do, eh, Greg?
I'm having enough troubles keeping the website going at all. It's hard work. I'm not very good at this application stuff. I'm better at networking than I am at others.
You see, Greg, if only you were able to multitask well.
Yeah, well, and that brings us to the next piece, which is that in a BBC posting this week, the brain splits to multitasking, and the article talks about the inability to deal with more than two things at a time may be hardwired into our brain. And the article says that basically, you know, if you're listening to music and studying, that's the limit of what you can do, or if you try and take on more than one task at a time, then you degrade in your capability. And the reason I like this article is that when I'm studying, I remember I used to listen to music and now I don't. I've written an article on my blog about this, about actually putting earplugs in my ears to help focus, to filter out the outbound noise. And I like that this article proves that what I think, you know, of course, when I'm right, I'm right. And I like this article that proves that the way that I'm doing things is obviously right. I don't believe in multitasking. I believe in, I actually have a quote somewhere which says, I don't multitask, I have distributed attention. And I am able to distribute my attention between several tasks, but one of the things that I've learned, especially now that I'm older, is that I can't do multiple things at once. I have to pick one thing and work on it until it's through. What do you guys think about that? Dan, are you particularly able to do a dozen things at once?
Not at all. If you look at studying, I'm one of these people who has to have complete silence to study. My wife's the opposite. She has to have music playing and the radio going and a whole pile of things going at the same time. I don't quite understand how she can study in that sort of environment, but I certainly cannot. And it's actually one of the bits of advice I was given when going to the CCIA lab is to take a set of earplugs with you to drown out the noise in the background so that you don't get distracted. What I find quite funny about this, I would love to have a job where I could do one thing at a time. Okay, this week's been an exception, but generally speaking, there's half a dozen people pushing you to do different things at the same time. And I think it does lead to the scenario where you do a less good job of things. If you can actually concentrate on one task, get it complete, get it finished, get it properly written up, you do a better job than if you're being constantly pulled from place to place. That's kind of my take on it.
Yeah, I will take a different tact and say one of the things I did when preparing for the CCIE exams, I studied typically with music on with headphones, but specific kind of music. I generally listen to classical music. I did not listen to pop music or really anything with vocals in it. Classical music, which I've been listening to off and on for most of my life, there's a lot of it I'm familiar with, and it was a way... It kind of accomplished for me the same thing that earplugs would for you, Greg, where I could block out all the background noise that might have been going on in the house or at work or wherever I was and just kind of put on some music there that would keep things calm and soothing and so on. And would allow me to focus pretty well. And I still do that at work today. If the office is really noisy, there's a lot of people yelling about who knows what, whether it's just people talking or phones ringing or whatever, I'll pop on the headphones. It's enough to drown out the office noise so I don't have all those vocal outbursts distracting me. And I can stay focused on whatever it is I'm doing, responding to email, finishing up a Visio diagram, any one of the half a dozen other things. Like you were just saying, Dan, yeah, all the different things people coming at you wanting to get things done. It's helpful to keep other things blotted out. But I guess I don't know if that qualifies as multitasking, because I'm almost using them as earplugs in that sense. You know what I mean?
Well, actually, at work, I don't listen to music because my company has a health and safety policy where we're not allowed to listen to headphones at our desks. That's because our office is actually classed as an industrial site for various reasons. But we are allowed to wear earplugs. The weird thing, of course, is that if people see you with earplugs in your ears, with headphones in your ears, they won't bother you, or they'll tap you on the shoulder, but they can't tell if you're wearing earplugs. So I've actually had people behind me going, you know, what, talking to me, and then eventually I
notice.
Need a mirror.
Yeah.
Gotta get a little mirror there so you know when they're sneaking up on you.
I think the best one for that's a previous colleague of mine just collected all the Cisco boxes that he unpacked over the years and just built a fort around himself so no one could tell whether he was in or out. Most people are too lazy to actually get up and walk over to have a look, so he kept them away that way.
I really like that idea.
And when the Juniper sales rep turns up, you can say, hey, look, you've got to replace all these boxes. All right. The idea, I mean, one of the challenges, of course, that we've got, or that I have, is certainly I have to keep studying to keep up with what's going on. So I think this idea of this multitasking thing is important because it's not always about studying for, it's also about the ongoing study that we have to do to stay up with new technologies or to get new, to keep up with the changes in the industry. And that's why that topic's important. And that brings us to the other thing I saw on a website this week was the on the Cool Tools website. It was the Universal Network Cable, which is a great gadget, which I quite like the look of, and I wish I could have one. It's a little device which actually has a male-female RJ45 connector and a selector in the middle, and it'll wire it through to the different connectors. There'll be a link in the show notes afterwards. But on one hand, I really like the idea of this, and on the other hand, I'm sort of looking at it going, is it really useful in the modern era? Because when we talked about this during the week, somebody said, well, you know, we just don't need these anymore because we don't have that many different devices. What's your – I know you had a view on that. Ethan, what are you thinking?
Oh, I would have one in my laptop right now. I'm probably going to order one. I got to go look at it again, but I was looking at that thinking of how handy that would be too, because there's been – any number of times I'm standing there at a rack of equipment and I'm going through my laptop bag trying to deal with some issue, troubleshoot something, and I can't get to whatever that device is. I pull that thing out, and no matter what you're trying to connect to, you're probably going to be able to at that point, whether it's Ethernet or you need a crossover or you need a Cisco sort of a setting, you're good. I think it's handy in a pinch.
First, the approach I'd take on it, I kind of tend to carry two cables with me. I carry a rollover, which handles the console port thing, and I carry a straight through. And then I just get the little 50-cent buy them off eBay crossover converters. Because as much as anything, they're nice and small and easy to carry, and I can leave them behind. They don't cost anything if I need to actually use them for something live, as it were. So I would kind of say, I mean, it's quite expensive to my mind. It's about $30, I think.
Yep.
Whereas you can sort of fill your bag with different connectors for that. But the fact that you'd never be able to actually use this and leave it somewhere because you'd want it back to me would be a restriction. But I do see the handiness of having something that you can just take one thing out, plug it in, and you know you're going to get a connection.
It's massive nerd geek kind of street cred to pull something like that out of your bag and plug it in. God, man. I mean, that might be worth $30 right there. I don't know. Maybe I'll spring for it. I'll tell you.
Well, if you do, make sure you come back and tell us all about it. All right. Is there anything else we want to talk about this week, or are we closed out the circuit?
I think we're good to go.
We're good to go. Okay. That's it for the show this week, and thanks for listening to Packet Pushers, and we should be back again in about a week or so, so make sure you come back. I'd like to thank Ethan Banks for joining us, and you can find him at his website at packetattack.wordpress.com, and he's also on Twitter as @ecbanks. Dan Hughes also blogs at blog.oloran.co.uk and occasionally at etherealmind.com with me, and his Twitter name is Dan Hughes, H-U-G-H-E-S, 1234-I-E. And I'm Greg Farrow, and you can find me at etherealmind.com or on Twitter at etherealmind. You can check out the podcast website at packetpushers.net or follow us and the blog and the podcast at @packetpushers. We'd love to hear about your feedback and about today's show. You can send us an email at packetpushers@gmail.com and let us know what you're thinking. And remember, too much networking would never be enough. Thank you.